He said he doing a lot better with this format than when he was doing stand-up comedy.
And now, a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. Buy your copy today. $20 is all it costs, plus $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to area code 706-399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006. A brief word from our sponsor, Reality Books, publisher of Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A short extract from the book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. God will not change the condition of a people until they change what is in themselves. In other words, until they change their way of thinking. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution is designed to help African Americans and other ethnicities change their way of thinking. This is a book that will change America, and it is on sale for only $20 plus $5 postage and handling. You can order your book now by sending a text message to area code 706-399-5006. Please put your name and the number of books that you would like to order, and you will be contacted to arrange payment information so that the book can be mailed to you immediately. So please go ahead and don't hesitate. Order your copy today. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, published by Reality Books. The author of this book is the great-grandson, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, the founder of the famous Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, now known as Tuskegee University. The great-grandson of Booker T. Washington is inviting you to order his book. Send a text to area code 706-399-5006. The book is only $20 plus $5 postage and handling. Order your copy today. Thank you. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome again to Booker T. Washington African American Family Room Forum. We're certainly very happy that you have joined us this evening in our African American Family Room, our virtual family room, our global virtual family room, for another discussion about issues pertaining to the African American Black community. And it's caller's choice tonight, so you can present whatever you would like to present. Just keep your initial comments short so everyone has a chance to speak, and then we'll give you another one or two opportunities to expand on what you start off with. But before we go any further, I do want to do a radio check with my co-host, Ms. Bianchi. Ms. Bianchi, are you able to hear me?
Yeah, you sound a little muffled.
I sound a little bit muffled. Well, I don't want to sound muffled. I'll try to do something to fix that if I can. We'll try something. Let's see. Okay.
Okay.
Ms. Bianchi, are you able to hear me now?
Yeah, matter of fact, I hear two of you.
Hold on just a minute. I got to fix that. Okay, one get it so you can hear me as clearly as possible. Okay. Tell me, is that any better, Bianchi?
It's a little bit better than what it was last, but why don't you go with that for a while and let others listen and comment?
Well, I got one more option. And then we'll try.
Okay. Mr. Bianchi, are you able to hear me better now?
That's not too bad, Mr. Washington. Why don't you roll with that?
We'll roll with this. Okay, thank you so much. Okay, sorry for a little technical issue, but we'll roll with this. Okay, so first, before I get started, I want to let our internet audience, because we do have usually about four or five times as many people that listen via the internet that just want to listen, as we have people that call in that want to contribute by being on the panel. So I want to let the internet audience know that we really invite and encourage you to dial in so we can hear your opinions about whatever's on your mind and whatever you hear others discuss. If you have some feedback, we'd like to hear it. And so the number to call is 657-383-0671. I'll try to remember to repeat that in a few minutes. But anyway, as I said, it's caller's choice tonight. I don't have any particular topic that I want to offer for discussion except this. I've been thinking about this all day, so I'm going to go ahead and put it out there. You know, as I travel throughout America, and even in the town where I live, you know, I see different segments of the African-American community, I see the very successful people. I see the upwardly mobile people, and that includes the high school and college students that are working to achieve the educational requirements to get in positions where they can have a comfortable life for themselves and their families, who are, for the most part, trying very hard to stay out of trouble with the law, so they have a clean record, not just to stay out of the jailhouses, but so they can be favorably considered for good jobs. And then I see those that don't seem to really have the motivation to do a whole lot of positive things with their lives. Some of them are not bad people at all. Most of them are not bad people at all. It's just that for some reason or other, whether it's lack of motivation from their home training, as we used to call it, or just the environment, peer pressure, whatever, they're just walking through life and basically getting into trouble, but if not getting into trouble, just not moving upwardly. So my question that I ask is, what can the successful members of the African American community do to help improve that situation, to help those that are farthest down, don't seem to really have a grip on what it takes to be quote-unquote successful, and are stumbling from one bad situation to the next? What can those who are successful do to help them? One of the things that has become one of my mantras is lifting as we climb, lifting up others as we climb up the ladder of success. So what can those who are successful do to help those that need more to motivate them and get them going in the direction of making a success out of their lives? And the follow-up question is, and if it is important to even consider doing that, and if it is, why? So I'm just going to throw that out there. As I say, you can pick up on and discuss it if you would like, but it was something that's been on my mind. So I'm going to leave it right there and now turn it over to our co-host for any comments. Don't have to be regarding that I just talked about. It can be anything, but I'll turn it over to my co-host at this time. Go ahead, Ms. Bianchi. I'm sorry. Ms. Bianchi, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you, Mr. Washington. Go ahead and pass it on to the next person. I'll listen.
Okay, well, fine. The next person, as we go around the family room, is Sheikh John Kenan Bay. So, Sheikh John Kenan Bay, as I said, you're free to comment on anything you want to. You don't have to feel obligated to respond to what I said. It's just something was on my mind. But I'll give it to you, and then you can take it in any direction that you would like. Go right ahead.
First of all, I'd like to say to everyone, good evening. You're speaking about something that's getting closer and closer to my heart. It's about education. What we haven't realized is that what's been the book has been very educated. So what we've done was we have a certain of the So if you think about it,
Hello?
We have somebody that's trying to speak right now, but welcome just to the program. Sheikh John Kenan Bay, can you hear me? Your signal's not Yeah, I know you can hear me, but I'm talking about the one who was speaking, say John Kenneth Bay.
John Kenneth Bay completely dropped out. I don't know what's going on with him.
Yeah, something's wrong with him.
Yeah, all right.
He fell overboard.
Yeah, I kind of walked away from my phone. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Go right ahead.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that there's an empire, the Mali Empire, and the remnants of it is still in place. I understand. A lot of those books are still there. The cultural aspect of that culture is still there, but it's not looked at import to the world. Being connected in relationship to them, we need to look more at that. We need to find out more about what occurred. I understand a lot of those books are still there. That maybe a lot of people don't understand it because of the language, but the educational system here, the way we were educated, a lot is missing. And that being said, that is missing. We need to find it. And that missing part, I think, would cause us to live to our potential. There's certain aspects of us that is missing. And now that being said, I personally right now am thinking about starting a school. And the reason I'm thinking about starting a school is because the focus on education right now is which of the ones in place are better. But when you examine them, you find that a lot is missing on both of them. So that which is missing, we need to put together a program and introduce our young people and let them fill a role in the gulf and those highs in them. So by that being said, and I said, my focus right now is seeing what I can do to contribute to the expansion of schools of that nature. I'd like to share my email address that anyone that wants to communicate to me of ideas, I would gladly receive them. My email is jkenonbey@imlcorp.com. Now, I also want to say that developing economic development of economic enterprises, I'm doing a dual role in that as well. I'm partnered with a cousin of mine. We have this business that's called INL, which we do manufacturing. And the manufacturing that we do is that of this level that it has required us to get IS-9100 certification, which is aircraft type of certification. So when you are in that arena and you have to meet those requirements, then you'll participate in very, very high standards. And if you're successful, that means a lot. We've been successful. We started. We're doing very, very poorly, but the auditors saw the effort we were trying to make. They worked with us and worked with us. It was from a small group of people work, but they are really good in their craft. So it's about 10. So I just want to say that this feeling that we could be much better than what we are, and it could be achieved by using the right approach and education is one of them. So I just want to throw that out. Anybody who feels the same way I do, like I said, I'll give you my email address and you can communicate with me, and we just move forward and work together.
Okay,
that's
well, thank you.
Tonight.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Sheikh John Kenneth Bay. Thank you so much. And we're going to move on around the family room, and I'm trying to see if I can recall the person that is associated with this particular number, but you may have to help me. So whoever has the number that begins with area code 313 and the last three digits, or 335, welcome to the show, and I'm going to let you identify yourself if you would like to. Please go ahead.
Hi, I would. Hi.
Yes.
Thank you.
Hi.
Thank you, Dr. Washington. It's a pleasure to be with you guys in the family room this evening. I'm calling you from Detroit, Michigan, and my name is Kathy House Vinson, and I am affiliated with the Detroit and National Association of ASALA, Dr. Carter G. Woodson's organization. And I've been invited by Jesus Muhammad Ali to listen and participate, and I wanted to let you know how valuable your podcast is to our community. To give you my view of your question, concern why those within our community who have achieved economic success I think many are contributing to the development of our youth. Much of it is not promoted in the public domain because the media does not, for whatever reasons, they want blood and gore, you know, gore. They don't want positive information to go out across the country on particular groups. So I think they downplay the success and the support that many of our successful people are giving. But that's a complex and multifaceted question you put to your audience tonight, because as you know, many of our communities have been decimated. Many of our schools are dumbing down. America is such a contemporary society. Most of the values and rules change daily. And the media is influencing so much of the youth in this country. So that's a multifaceted and complex question you ask. But I think there are places within the country and people who are doing substantive work with our youth. And I'd like to commend Paul Adams III on the west side of Chicago with Providence St. Mel School. For the past 42 years, every child has graduated and gone on to baccalaureate institutions. He has committed his life, and that kind of question you ask is a life commitment. And all I do to simplify it is to work within my family with the young people who are in my family, and those young people that I come in contact with who express a desire to be guided and who want to listen. We recently had a terrible, tragic situation here in Detroit. There was a young brother, looked to be in his 40s or so, who lived across the street from a gas station. And he frequented the gas station. So while he was at the gas station, there were these two young brothers, I believe 15 and 16, who were soliciting funds. They were begging. And he said, well, you know, hey, you guys, I live right across the street. And he had an injury. And he said, I can't do some of the work around my house that I used to do. So I want you to think of coming over and helping me do some basic chores, et cetera. So he hired these two young brothers. He lived there, his girlfriend and a five-year-old son of hers. I don't know if it was theirs or hers. Do you know those two boys worked for him for a few weeks and then they came back to try and rob him and kill them and kill gangland style that five-year-old child? So I say that to say, you within our families, there are many youth that need help. There are some in the community who are striving, trying to make it on their own. But it's a very, this society is so full of violence, and so many of our people are so lost and confused. We don't have the community that we once had. You know, when we came up, if you walked on someone's grass or dropped a piece of paper or a bubblegum wrapper on the grass, they come out and check you, and you respect their response to you, and they tell your parents. And, you know, that all that community has been devastated by means. And we are so caught up in daily survival, many of us, particularly after the pandemic. Our mental health issues are we're in need of assistance there. They took away all the mental health facilities in Michigan under Governor Engler. So we you know, by God's grace, we are here because they have done everything to us. But all I can say is that each of us does a little bit. I believe that cumulatively, collectively, that will make a huge impact. But the schools have been dumbed down. We need to look to Providence St. Mel School in the ghetto on the west side of Chicago. He had to go private. He can't let these federal people and all these other people tell him to have his teachers teach to the test. He had to go private. And we may need more, like we used to have, our own little schools, because
the educational system in urban environments in this country has been depleted and are dummying down, many of them dummying down our children. So thank you for letting me share some of my suggestions and observations, and I'll let someone else have your floor in the family room. Thank you.
Well, thank you so very, very, very much for being on our panel tonight. To have you on the program is quite an honor for me and for all of us. And hopefully you will return regularly and invite others that you know to come on when they can to give their views. We normally, and you can pass this on, we normally make the topic caller's choice. So if anyone you know has a particular topic that they would like to discuss, gives them an opportunity to get it out there where we can hear it. But also these programs are archived, and I will make sure that I text you. I have your phone number now because it's on my studio computer screen, and I'm going to make sure that I text you the website that has almost five years worth of archives of these programs that we've discussed over the last four years. Great topics.
You know, this society was built on false truths anyway, so it's all crumbling. And the churches aren't doing what they should be doing in our communities. The city council and the city councils, I have some friends here who are very involved in Detroit, and they're in their early 80s now. They don't even vote for city council. It's a smoke and glass. So if we teach our history, that's why when I returned home to Detroit, we hadn't had a branch of OSALA, Dr. Woodson's organization that he founded in 1915, before he founded Black History Week, originally, as you know. So we hadn't had a branch here since 1986, and I worked my tail off to reestablish the OSALA Detroit, and we meet under normal conditions at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History, which before the Smithsonian African American Museum was built, that was the largest. Ours was the largest in the country. So we meet the second Sunday of every month on Zoom right now. We'll be meeting back at the Wright Museum probably soon. But, you know, what can you expect? And I believe that Honorable Elijah Muhammad and your great-grandfather and other people who worked and loved our people, you can't get righteousness from someone who has enslaved you. So I encourage you guys, when it comes to education, to look at Providence St. Mel. They have a website. Call Paul Adams. He sacrificed his whole life for those kids to be educated. And he couldn't get his teaching license when he finished school in Alabama because he had been an activist. So he migrated to Chicago, and the rest is history. He just had a student recently to score a perfect score on the ACT, and this young man wants to be a neurosurgeon. His mother went to Providence St. Mel, but she didn't finish. But there are places in the country that are doing this. We got Piney Woods. As you all know, Piney Woods is down in Mississippi. That's still a relative good educational institution.
We have to be, as you know, we have to be the masters of our own lives
and shifts in education, because we cannot expect. We're still captive people in this country, from my perspective. And those children who are coming from unhealthy environments, spiritually, mentally, emotionally, psychologically, we really need some more boarding schools or places that can take them in and help them and guide them, because there are so many being entrapped into gangs and negative activities among us. Detroit is a chocolate city, 71% black city, and it's tough. We have, you know, lots of young people who are going astray. The schools have failed them. Their parents have failed them. So if we, you know, every little bit we all do to turn things around or to help the kids and our family, first of all, and then help some kids who really demonstrate they want help, maybe through a church auxiliary or something, but this media is destroyed. As you all know, this media showing the sisters showing their behinds and shaking and breaking and the brothers being transgender and looking more like women than men, it's by design. It is. I was in the bank yesterday and a young brother came in a suit. He looked so nice. And I complimented him. I said, young man, I have to tell you, you really look good. Thank you, ma'am. And there was another one in front of him who looked okay. You know, I had to compliment him too. He looked okay. He wasn't dressed in a suit, but he was dressed neat without showing his backside. I said, you guys make me feel proud to see you like this. You know, but we have to encourage them, and we have to be careful, though, because there are some out here, girls and boys, who are violent, who have the guns. As Jesus can tell you in Chicago, how do they get the guns? How do they get them in Detroit? That they don't get all those guns by breaking and entering on people. But those guns are placed in certain environments, in certain communities, in alleys and places where they can get access to them. So thank you again. I'm sorry.
No, that's wonderful. Thank you. I'm going to turn it over to next to Minister Jesus Muhammad Ali, and then who has been waiting very patiently, Brother Warren. But I do want to just insert something real quick. Many years ago, when I was a cadet officer at the All-Black St. Emma Military Academy, I have some static in the background. Someone asked everyone to go ahead for right now, mute your phone, see if we can clear up that static. If you can just mute your phone, maybe that'll clear up the static. And I was fortunate to meet a young man from Detroit. His name was Theophile Schinnevert. He was known by the nickname of Pete. I was a senior, and I was an officer, and he was assigned to my cadet company for training. And I saw that he needed a strong guiding hand among the other young men. He was one of those that seemed almost like he was lost. And so I took him under my wing. I learned later after I had graduated that he did very well at that school and became a cadet officer himself. Years later, we reconnected, and he was involved in a number of community development projects, one of which was to try to preserve the legacy of the institution that both of us had graduated from. Unfortunately, about, I guess maybe 19 or 18 years ago, he was brutally murdered in Detroit by some carjackers, shot in the head. And so here we have a young man who all of his life, to the best of my knowledge, strove to seek out guidance and follow guidance from elders and other mentors and develop himself into a very fine, upstanding young man. But because he was from Detroit, he loved riding through the streets of Detroit. When he was growing up, the streets weren't dangerous as they are today, and he felt comfortable going into an area where this incident occurred, and he lost his life. So even though we have those like Pete Schinnevert and many, many, many others who are very upward bound, very success motivated, and willing to reach down and help others, there are still those that not only are they a blight on our community, but they are a real danger to our community. But by the time a young man gets to be 15 or 16 years old, I'm not saying it's impossible to turn him around. But if we don't catch these young folks by the time they're 5 years old, we're going to lose too many of them. And so that's why I concur with Sheikh John Kenan Bay when he speaks about the boarding schools. I have for many, many years, and I traveled throughout the country over the last 20 years, speaking in many different venues, and I haven't been at all reticent to say or about saying that we need to have more schools like the one that I graduated from when I was 17 years old. I got there when I was 14. I had, 15. I had done 1 year in a public or semi-public Tuskegee Institute High School, and then I went to this school, and it was the best training experience I could have ever experienced. And I just wish there were so many more young people kind of instruction and motivation and discipline. So having said that, I want to go ahead now and welcome again Minister Jesus Muhammad Ali. And we have you and Brother Warren, who's waiting very patiently. So please make your statement as concise as possible so he can come on and we'll give you the opportunity to come back. Minister Jesus Muhammad Ali, please go ahead. You may still be on mute. If you're on mute, you need to come off mute because I can't hear you right now.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Greetings of peace in paradise. I'm going to give you greetings. As-salamu alaykum. And I want to thank Ms. Kathy House for her joining us this evening. I think I mentioned her. She's been a very close friend, and her and her husband here in Detroit. She's a native of Detroit, and she worked very diligently with in the academia here in the colleges and universities, and her and her husband have been a close friend of mine for more than 15 years. And as I say, she's a native of Detroit. Her father was a barber, but you know, one of the things I would like to say in a cursory way on this subject is, it is truly heartbreaking, okay? And to see our young people, I can't really emphasize it or overemphasize how heartbreaking it is for me to see our young people in the condition, and they're somewhat, I would almost consider an aimless way of growing. Our children are not, so many of our young children are not, they're not being raised. They're just growing up. There's some silence in the background. Someone's trying to work on some tools or something. But anyway, so many of our young people, they're just aimlessly growing up. You know, even in my book that was published about 20 years ago, The Evolution of the Nation of Islam, I talk about how, I use the word welfare bride, because once our young girls get to the age where they can, have babies of their own and then be given a check from Washington, D.C., and have so many single-parent children born out of these kinds of, the social dynamics that is associated with this welfare bride situation. Just once they get old enough, they want to get out from under their parents, and so they start having their own babies. And but even my grandfather, Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he spoke about, referred to us as being up from slavery. I mean, when you talk about slavery, I mean, I know that, many of the Caucasians of this, and even when I was going through college and going to, myself, they, many white, and even many of our black educators and black people also say, that, you know, this pity pot attitude, constantly wanting to blame the white man for our shortcomings, you know, but, you know, the secular nature of the 15 generations of having been subject to being family and culture. I mean, this is part of the reason why they refer to our people when this country was founded as being 3/5 of a human being. In part, it had to do with, you know, just having stripped us of our culture and our language. Okay, and there's so much. You know, I mean, man is a social animal. I mean, there's a book called, a psychiatrist has recently written a book called Healing, but, you know, he wants to talk about how, you know, this pandemic has, even psychiatrists have had to go to see the psychiatrist because this pandemic over the last 2 years has exacerbated, you know, many of the other problems that our society has been victim to. But Detroit, specifically, as Ms. Kathy House was pointing out, you know, see, Detroit, and as you mentioned also about a friend of yours who came here and was murdered. I mean, I've lived here coming out of Chicago, raised in Chicago, but I too am a product of the University of Islam, which is the subject Professor Abui, you know, you received your, in my understanding, you received your master's degree based on your thesis about the University of Chicago, a teacher yourself in the University of Chicago in California. So, you know, and my grandfather, you know, he would not allow any of his teachers at the University of Islam to teach in the University of Islam unless he personally interviewed them. And most of our teachers came out of the South. The Southern teachers, they had a true love for our people. And one of the statements Ms. Kathy House mentioned about dummy, these schools dummying us down. I mean, internet, okay, and there's a personal relationship, you know, between a child and his parents, and if there is no love there, okay, and the pedestal of love, the pedestal on which love rests is respect. And one of the things my grandfather emphasized more over than anything else is that we have respect for one another, okay? And only ones we seem to give respect for is, you know, those people, you know, who are part of the dominant society. We are a subculture, okay? And it can't overemphasize the fact that we are a subculture, and the people who, you know, are of the dominant culture, if we don't aspire and have a sense of being inspired to do something, like, you know, which Mrs. Kathy House said, you don't have anything to work with if a person don't have a sense. You know, some people are just satisfied with waking up in the morning and having something to eat, or either, you know, what we call perennial interest. I mean, every day, as far as they're concerned, is a party. I mean, see, this is not about sex and violence. They're not interested. You can't get any interest out of them. It's very, very disheartening. Well, I'm going to go ahead and pass it on to Brother Warren, because I'm always very interested in Brother Warren's comments. But I thank you for listening, and I'm going to give you greetings of Assalamu alaikum as I
thank
open.
You. Oh, thank you so much, Mr. Jesus Muhammad Ali. And since we began, in addition to those who were with us, we also have Sister Baina and Dr. Calvin Nobles. So this is going to be a great, great night for a very interactive discussion, and we're going to go ahead now and give the mic to Brother Warren. Brother Warren, you're on.
Greetings to everyone from the great city of New Orleans, Louisiana. Spring is on the way, and so the weather is nice today. We were able to work in the yard and eat crawfish today. So we want to bring greetings from New Orleans. As the young sister from Detroit was speaking, I looked on my bookshelf and pulled out a book entitled Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination by Herb Boyd. I hadn't started to read it yet, but it's up there on the shelf in line to be read. And Remy Albert Cleage, who also was based in Detroit, I want to read a something from him that he wrote as it relates to the topic that you introduced, Mr. Washington. He says, Black life in America constituted a process by which a proud African people were niggerized. Black people in America have been programmed for inferiority, deliberately, consistently, exquisitely. The white man's declaration of black inferiority is basic to all American life. There is no institution in America, no aspect of life, that does not basically reflect the declared inferiority of all black people. Not poor black people, not ignorant black people, not uncouth black people, but all black people have been declared inferior. This declaration of black inferiority is the foundation on which American history has been built. From the time black people were brought to these shores as slaves, the declaration of black inferiority was the framework within which the black man was forced to build his existence. In the slave ship, on the slave block, on the plantation, fleeing from the lynch mob, fleeing north into slum ghettos, the black man was not only declared inferior, but everything possible was done to make that declaration a statement of fact. The black man could accept this declaration of inferiority or he could reject it. And for the early part of his existence in America, the black man accepted the white man's declaration of black inferiority. As a slave, systematically separated from the people who spoke his language, living in a country about which he knew nothing, not even the simple geography necessary to attempt escape, he was forced to accept the authority of the white slave master to define his person and the conditions of his existence. The black man had no alternative to an acceptance of the white man's declaration of his inferiority. His freedom had been taken from him. His culture had been taken from him. His history had been taken from him. His language had been taken from him. His dignity had been taken from him. He had nothing left but his physical being and the will to survive. Black people learned to live with this declaration of black inferiority, and self-hate became a basic characteristic of the black people's life in America. Now, that's from the late Rev. Albert Cleage, Jr. And what you were describing and what we all see in these communities across America where we see elements of our population who appear to be hopeless, walking around like zombies, is from this fact that we carry this sense of inferiority in us. And even with Black is Beautiful, and I'm Black and I'm Proud, and the African Senate movement, we have not been able to stomp out that inferiority because the mass media that always transforms itself made sure that what is called black culture for these young people is that inferiority. And what many of these young people identify as black culture is a type of rap or hip-hop music, a certain style of dressing and fashion, a sort of rudeness and disrespect. And so that for them becomes black culture. That becomes the essence of what it means to be black. And so therefore, I'm not going to try to be a doctor. I'm not going to try to be an engineer because in a subconscious way, the message is communicated that's not black culture. I want to be what the lyrics in the song say I am, or be, you know, all those profane words, you know, we don't need to say them. Even the so-called successful black people, they cannot do anything for the least fortunate because they too have an inferiority complex, Mr. Washington. You have black people in corporate America. You have black people who are superintendent of school districts, black school board members, black city council members. Can't do anything, can't be creative because they too have an inferiority complex when they get around those white folks and they want to show off in front of those white folks and actually do what those white folks want them to do. And that's why I'm so hard on black people at this point who accepts that same mass media that projects us as inferior 24/7 to accept their narrative about the war in Russia. To be made to feel you have to join the bandwagon of feeling sympathy for Ukrainians. And I told some the other day, I said, don't you realize that same warlike effort that Western Europe and the United States is going towards Russia is already done to us here in America? Mm-hmm. The sanctions they want to put on Russia, we're already sanctioned here in America. There's already severe sanctions on us. You know,
that's right.
And we have to understand this kind of stuff. You know, Russia is part of the world economy, so to sanction Russia, everybody's going to feel a pain. But we ain't part of no world economy. You see what I'm saying? So if these people wanted us to participate and to be in a competitive race as Booker T. Washington wanted us to be, they'd have done this a long time ago. You see? And so, in essence, as I close, it's the sense of inferiority that our young people inherit from the black adults. Successful, quote unquote, or not successful. Many of the young people, when you approach them and ask them if they want to be a doctor, some become angry. Doctor? I'm not going to be in school. I don't want to be in school, no more school. So you have this among many elements of the young people. And so I think that to solve and address a lot of these problems, the first declaration American blacks are going to have is no more dependence on a type of government solution because it has been a part of the problem in many respects. You know, when you sanction, you know, the U.S. have sanctions over a third of the world's countries. And these sanctions actually kill. But what is happening with many of these countries, they're learning how to go and get along and survive without U.S. support. And that's a good thing. And it reminded me during Jim Crow and segregation when black people were not a part of anything. And so therefore we had to develop our own internal networks and various organizations and societies and enterprises to help each other. And so with all of this material stuff we have in our hand today, we should declare ourselves no more government solutions to our problems, because when you look at the successful blacks overall, one of the reasons why they can't help the least less fortunate blacks is because their whole life is caught up into trying to participate and prove themselves worthy in an organized structures that really don't see their worth at all. I look at this black lady who's the UN ambassador, the American ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas Greenfield. She's from this area out here in Louisiana. And I look at her participation with a lot of this criminal activity that our government does around the world. And all she's doing is reading the scripts that the white folk have written, and she reads them. And I don't know if she realizes how criminal she sounds. And I said, our people didn't fight to be just like these criminal people, but so many of us are in these jobs, and we're carrying ourselves with the same value that these white folks are teaching us. And I told you last week, God will not bless us if all we want to do is imitate and emulate the people who have abused us more than what the devil would have done. Thank you, Mr. Washington.
I would like to comment when I can on Brother Warren.
I would also like to comment.
Okay, let me do this, please.
because we want to make sure everybody has the opportunity to do their initial statement, and then we'll be open for responses to those statements in just a minute. But I do want to give Sister Baena an opportunity to make an initial statement, and also Dr. Nobles. And so if you can just defer the comment for just a few minutes so they get their initial comments out to us, then we'll come back to you. So thank you for that deferral. Sister Baena, welcome to the program. It's so nice.
Yes. As-salamu alaykum, everyone. Good evening. Peace and blessings. Driving, so I'm going to try to be brief with what I have to tell you. I heard a sister from down in Louisiana today on the Lifeline this morning. Her name is Sister Rashida. I can't remember her last name. Excellent psychiatrist. But anyway, the problem that we have in society right now is that we don't have any morals or decency, and we have fallen down as a people, as a community. No one is teaching our children morals and decency or righteousness, and we have to try and save our children, and the only way we're going to do that is through the school system, because they spend most of their day there, and most of them are probably coming from single-parent homes. So there's nobody home when they get there. We have gangs out here trying to recruit them in middle school or whatever. And as a people, I think we have to blame the older people or the elderly people or not everyone, but we have fallen down. We need to go and adopt a school in our community, I think. People who are retired and have skills, and go there and talk to the school administrators and find out what it is that they need in their school system, because, you know, there are three things in life that we have going on out here. We have things that we control, things that we don't control, and we have circumstances. And we have circumstances that we're not in control of. So that's my solution and what I have to say about that. I'm not trying to blame the Caucasian anymore for anything. So we know what that's all about. We don't have to keep revisiting that. We just have to keep it moving, okay, and never give up. I don't think our people ever gave up. And Sister Clara Muhammad, may Allah be well pleased with her. Her name was Clara. Clara means to clarify, because she's the person that started homeschooling in this country, whether they give her credit for that or not. And we have to take back our own schools. We have to take back the schools. Most of our people are in the public schools. We can't afford to go to a private school. And I just want to leave you with this before I stop. Our children are not learning coding. Coding is a necessary skill that they have to have. There's an app that's called the Grasshopper, and you can use it on your phone or you can download it onto a PC. Maybe someone should go and talk to the librarians and see if they can set up some classes at the public library or in the public school system where you can one-on-one with children and teach them coding with that Grasshopper. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sister Baena. Thank you very, very much. And now we want to bring on my dear friend, and all of you are my friends, but my fraternity brother and dear friend and mentor for a number of years, my role model, Dr. Calvin Nobles. Dr. Nobles, welcome to the program again.
Brother Cabinet, thank you. Thank you for everybody that's on the call tonight. And I missed the beginning as I was finishing up my daily chores around the house. But I am glad I tuned in tonight. I heard several of the last discussion points. And I do want to say, I heard the last lady point loud and clear. She said that we need to teach our kids coding. And I had a congressman office call me about a month ago, and he said, well, our congressman won't work with you all to set up hackathons for our kids. And I said, I agree. I would love to set up hackathons for the kids, but here's my concern. So I work at the Illinois Institute of Technology up in Chicago. Our school is on the south side. And I said, here's my concern. Most of our students don't even own a laptop. Most of our students don't know how to actually navigate a computer. So we have a digital literacy problem in our community. And first, we need to address that. Second, we need to understand something. We got to stop asking for small things. coding is good, but we got to start asking for STEM camps because everybody's not going to be a coder. Everybody wasn't turned out. Everybody don't have the mental capacity to be a coder. But you might not be a coder, a software developer, a software engineer, but you might could be an aerospace engineer, or you might could be a doctor. And so one of the things I did, I recently reached out to Dr. Calvin Mackey down in New Orleans, and he put me on to some things that he's doing. And so the one thing I say about coding is an opportunity for, I'll be honest, if you can do it and do it well, you can always eat. You will always be able to earn a very decent salary and be able to sustain your livelihood. I'm not going to lie about that part. That part is true. But the part that concerns me is that our kids are so far behind. And everybody, and like I said, everybody's not going to become a software engineer, a software developer, a computer scientist. But if we can expose them to various forms of STEM, let them find out what comes natural for them in STEM and push and help push them that way. And so and when I responded to the congressman's office with that response, they agreed with me. And we've been working to bring across different STEM camps to some of the kids in Chicago because we realize these kids are not only at a disadvantage, they also have a huge curve to overcome. And that digital literacy curve, we can't start with the students. We've got to start with the parents because the parents are part of this too. We got to teach the parents how to operate computers. We got to teach them how to become smart with these computers because a lot of the kids don't have cable at home. They don't have internet at home. They don't have devices at home so they could take their work home and continue their progress. So everything they learn has to be within the school system. And so there's only a limited amount of time they can do that. And so I agree. We need to teach our kids STEM, and there's a whole heap of resources out there that's free. We just got to package it in a way so that kids get something out of it. Because I will tell you, there's nothing more dejecting or demoralizing than trying to learn the code and you don't get it. Because then the kid becomes really dejected and turned away from technology altogether. So we teach kids not only how to code, we teach kids to think about cybersecurity, to think about information technology, to think about digital forensics, to think about data analysis, because those are some really amazing career opportunities. And so I've been at Illinois Tech for about 7 months now, and one of my strategic objectives I set for myself was to bring those type of programs through the school to our community so our kids could come up to speed because one of my first weeks on the job, I went to a school on the north side in Chicago, and these kids walked in. They had laptops, MacBook Pros, rather. They had iPads, and they just had the best of both worlds. And I said, excuse me, this is a CPS school. They said, yes, this is a Chicago public school. And I'm like, this is a stark difference than what I've been told. Why is this school so different than on the south side? And we all know why, and we got to work to fix that. I've been working with corporations. I've been working with Microsoft, Google, Apple, corporations around Chicago. I've been working with a state representative, Mr. Lamont Robinson, who chairs the state committee for technology, and we've been working to enhance those things in the community, and we're going to start this summer with summer camps. And so he actually made some donations to the school, and we're going to start there to looking to expand this out, not just during the summer, but year-round. We just got to have a starting point, right? And so there's plenty of opportunity because our kids are so far behind. And so I could talk a thousand minutes about this stuff, but I'm not because I know other people on the call. But I'm just glad to be on the call and make this point because, you know, STEM is the way to go. I struggle with this in my family, and I'm trying to be an advocate for others to show how STEM can change the trajectory of your lives and your financial situation for your family.
Dr. Nobles, thank you so very much. And I do want to let the Internet audience know, I meant to do this earlier in the program, that if you have some comments that you would like to make, I want you to call in. So before we close, because we will be closing in another approximately 10 minutes, I want to let the people who are listening on the Internet know that we invite you and encourage you to call in so before the show closes tonight, we can hear what's on your mind. The number to call
is 657-383-0671. I don't ever let the show end without those who are sitting on the edge of their chair, so to speak, be able to say the final things that may be pressing on their mind. So here's what we're going to do. I want to invite Ms. Cassie House, since she did have a response to something that had been said earlier, I guess by Brother Warren. We want to let her go next. And then anyone else that has something that you feel you want to say.
Ms. Washington.
Please. Yes, just one moment.
Is it okay if I go next and then let, because I got to leave, and then let Calvin close out?
Well, the lady from Detroit,
I wanted to ask her a couple questions before I left.
Okay, that's fine. Go right ahead, Mr. Ken.
Yeah, you know, I guess you'd be living in Detroit. You know, I've done a project out on Highway 75, an office building, across the street from the Michigan Highway Patrol. And that was back in 1973 because I had a brand new Ford Thunderbird at the time. And are you familiar with that building? Is it still there by chance?
Ms. House, I think he's asking you. Is that right? Are you asking Ms. House?
Yeah, Ms. House. If she's still on, she might have dropped off.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay. I was in undergrad school then, and I matriculated in Chicago, where I lived for 30 years before moving back home to Detroit. So I'm not familiar with it. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I've done a project on that building. Bethlehem Steel, which was a major steel company in the country, they paid I lived in St. Louis. They paid my travel to Detroit to their project. They paid my food, and they paid my housing while I was on that project. And at the time, it was those type of opportunities that exist. I'm very familiar with Chicago, because we worked for American Bridge during the time that they was building the Sears Tower. And
nice.
I also done a project out in Schaumburg, Illinois,
mm-hmm.
which is right outside Chicago City. Are you familiar
right.
with Schaumburg?
Oh, yeah. I'm familiar with most of Chicago.
Yeah. So those opportunities are even more so today. You talk about the
correct.
Schools in Detroit. You had a lot of schools. Detroit had a program that put a culture theme curriculum throughout the school district. Back during the time they had Kwame.
We got that from Dr. Barbara Sizemore in Chicago, the start of the African-centered curriculum. And Detroit,
actually,
I wasn't just talking about Detroit schools. I'm talking about,
mm-hmm.
I said, all urban schools that dummy it being dummied down. And the brother who mentioned STEM careers, all I can say to that is he is right on. But our kids need math. If you have math skills, you can do mostly a lot of different kind of career things, including coding, software engineering, and all of that. I was just reading before I chimed in on a brother who just retired in June. I don't know how many of you knew about him. His last name was Frazier, out of Philadelphia. His daddy had been a janitor. His mother died when he was 12, and this brother is retiring from being one of the tops at AT&T. No, not AT&T, at Merck Pharmaceuticals. He has over 600,000 pieces of stock with the company. He's in Philadelphia, 67 years old. Got his JD from Harvard, but he retired. He's worth so many million. But the point I wanted to make before we close out is that the sister mentioned about private schools. What Paul Adams has done over on the west side in the ghetto of Chicago, he fundraises because those kids can't afford it. So he fundraises. But I know the post-traumatic slave syndrome, Dr. DeGruy, we had her here in Detroit right before the pandemic. Fantastic sister doing fantastic work. I know the Clegg family's well. My dad ran for state rep here in 1950. He was in the vanguard of the black political movement here and very active in his community. The nephew of Reverend Clegg is right now the head of Wayne County. Wayne County is all of Detroit. He is the man over it. They just announced on the news 2 nights ago that they're naming part of Detroit Metro Airport after him. Warren Clegg. He came up. He was sheriff. He was head of the sheriff's department here. And since I've been back 20 years, and, you know, they're still following the old, you know, the Eurocentric way. Now, he came up, his mother, he's the son of Clegg's brother, who was a physician. But he, you know, he's doing some things, but he's doing it through the way that this country and who has been developed by. And when you create the game, you have to play the game. So he's, you know, these folk play the game. Now, the brother out of Louisiana, I was going to Egypt with your group that just went. But I decided not to go because of pandemic. But I wanted to see not too many. I hope Dr. Jeffries, both of them will be here for a long, long time. But I really wanted to participate in that conference. But we have to do our own thing, like Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Booker T. Washington, Honorable Booker T. Washington did. We have to have our own. You cannot, I'm going to say it again, you cannot expect more from the people who enslaved you. They're not going to do for you. And right now in America, we're not even an item other than in voting. They have no cause for us. They have no interest in us. This is my perspective. We've had our, they've used us and they finished with us. And once they, if they could eliminate the voting aspect for us, we wouldn't even have, we wouldn't even be mentioned. We're not even mentioned in most political campaigns. Biden has been committed to doing some of the things he said he would do, but we have to do for self. You know, nobody's going to do for us but each other. And we do have all of those isms because of slavery. But a little bit we can do, each of us can do within our families, within our communities, collectively it would be massive. Anytime we progress in this country, the history has shown, Roseville, or Oklahoma, you know, I'm rushing out because Doc needs to get back, but anytime we have created some, Detroit, they put the drugs in the community when I was a teenager to eliminate the middle class. It was done by design. I'm going to stop talking. Thank you, and let someone else have the floor.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, here's what we're going to do. I'm about to finish the program for this week, but I definitely want to be, the best word I can say is right, and allow those who still have something they want to say to have that opportunity, but I'm just going to ask you to make it brief and concise. So if you will do that, then we'll begin with Sheikh John Kennebay, then Brother Warren, and then Minister Jesus Muhammad Ali, and then Sister Baina. And we're going to ask Brother Calvin, Calvin Nova, to be still on, if he'll give us the final commentary for the night for the program. So, Sheikh John Kennebay, do you have any closing comment that you would like to make at this time?
No, the only thing I have to say is that I have enjoyed the conversation. I'm glad that we are aware of the problem, and we all have an interest in trying to resolve this problem for our posterity. Peace.
All right. Well, very good. Very good. So, Brother Warren, would you like to make any final comments before we close tonight?
Yes, I like to say it doesn't matter how many resources or opportunities that exist. If our young people in large numbers have an inferiority about themselves, they won't go to take advantage of those things. You have in many of our HBCUs, in particular, like here in New Orleans, we have Xavier University that's very strong in STEM. And I was just talking to a friend yesterday. She was telling me about the physician assistant program. I think that's what it's called. They have a physician assistant program in the undergrad. And she was looking at the pictures of the students And you had one black male. You had, then the other males were of some other ethnic persuasion. And then you had about three or four black females, and then all the other females were of some different ethnic persuasion. And this is HBCU. So if our young people are not in these environments in school where the academics is rigorous for them, then it doesn't matter what resources that are there for them, they won't be able to take advantage of it. In fact, what I would recommend to parents, black parents in America, is you should do two things for the welfare of your child. Number one, demand that your child not be passed unless they've mastered the essentials of what they're supposed to in their grade level before they move to the next. Okay, get rid of the social promotion. Because a lot of our kids are just being passed on all the way through high school, and then that becomes political because the school districts are under pressure for statistics and so on and so forth. So they graduate, and then they don't have any skill. They don't know anything. And so I started my presentation out with the concept of inferiority. We as black people carry this. Even when we got PhDs, MDs, JDs, we carry this inferiority around us. We put on airs with each other. We show off. And then at the end of the day, the whole world see that we haven't built anything for our young people. And that's why they can see our young people all out roaming around doing different things, because we haven't built anything for our own people while we're showing off the positions and titles we got. Thank you.
Brother Cabinets, were you there?
Did the call drop?
No, I was just trying to go right ahead. Please go right ahead.
I thought it was next. I thought someone else was coming before me. But I just want to say that our whole community needs to get into the teaching modality mode. We need to get in that mode and save our children. And, yes, I was talking about coding because I know that people need to be employable. But STEM is something that's needed in every school system. But like I said before, we all need to adopt a school. If we can afford to, we need to go and adopt a school. We need to go to the school, talk to the principal, find out what that school in the neighborhood needs, and go from there. And then try and organize the parents in the community sense. But we have to save our children. We have to save them. Thank you.
Thank you, Sister Bain. I'm going to ask Miss Kathy House in just a minute if you'd like to make any closing comments, but I don't want to leave tonight without saying something that's been part of my educational promotion agenda for many, many years. And without giving a lecture on the history of education, I just want to say this, that part of the development of public education in America in the 1800s had a lot to do with the Americanization of the immigrants. And part of it was to prepare them to be workers in the American industrial capitalistic society. And so the grade system was developed so that the administrators could measure the social development and the what I would say acclimatization or the absorption of the American values and track how students were doing. And so they were putting grades, and part of it had to do with their ability to learn the basics, what they used to call the 3 R's. I have a different theory, having been involved in education for the last 50 years at various levels, higher education, secondary education, and primary education. And I have come to the conclusion
that system needs to change, that the grading system needs to be abolished, and what is called in industry the badge system needs to be adopted, so that as students accumulate at whatever age they may be, badges of competency in different fields, for example, basic English, basic math, algebra, whatever they get. And when they have accumulated enough badges, whether they accumulate the basic math badge when they're in the sixth grade or whether they're accumulated when they're in the fourth grade, when they have accumulated enough badges, they get graduation certificate. And the reason for this, and I've studied this extensively, I'm not boasting, but I am a PhD, all but dissertation complete, scholar in the field of education, and I have studied the fact that students learn different things at different levels. And so to push a student ahead into another grade that is only mediocrely mastered math, for example, and to me a C is a mediocre accomplishment, is not fair to that student, because it's going to catch up with that student when that student, if that student chooses to go to college or even to a technical school, if they haven't mastered the fundamentals. And C does not represent mastery. So I think that they should wait until that student has demonstrated mastery of whatever the discipline is, and then give them the badge at whatever age that person may be within the general context of primary or secondary education. So a student may, as I said earlier, he may be in what would be considered the seventh grade, but it may be then when the light comes on and he finally masters that math. And that's when you give him that credential or that badge. But anyway, I don't want to discuss that tonight. We can pick it up at another one of our programs. So at this time, Ms. Kathy House, would you like to add any concluding comments?
No, thank you. I've really enjoyed being a part of this discussion with many of our community leaders who are concerned about our future. And I thank you, and I will try and attend next week. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And please invite your friends and colleagues.
I will.
Yes, because we like to have a broad range of ideas, and we certainly invite everyone to invite your friends and colleagues to participate. So we're going to ask our dear friend, Dr. Calvin Nobles, for the closing commentary, and then we'll be finished for this evening. Dr. Nobles.
Thank you for this opportunity, and I would like to say what a very heartfelt discussion tonight, as we talk about some things that are very near and dear to our hearts as well as our community. The kids and our students in our communities are the future of our community. And as leaders of our and pillars of our community, we must work harder to establish the foundations and the platforms they need to be successful. This morning I was on a call with about, I think it was about eight of us, and there was a dean from HBCU on the call, and we were talking about research, and we got on the subject of HBCUs, and one of the things that we discussed was the current state of cybersecurity curriculum at HBCUs, and to be honest with you, it's not where it really needs to be. I just share a number with you. As of last month in the United States, there was over 500,000 cybersecurity job vacancies. And that's why it's a concern for us, is because that number is only getting larger every month. And what are we doing? We are trying to help HBCUs understand that building cybersecurity curriculum and giving students of color an opportunity will be life-changing in this particular area. Now, this is not the only area. There's many other areas that are growing, but this is the area where we notice that HBCUs are really struggling with. And so we're going to actually do a study, put it in writing, and share it with HBCUs, because when you put things in writing, things tend to have a different perspective. and just show how we can, you know, rally around HBCUs to help build this particular curriculum for them. But, again, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, especially in our communities and our schools, and even with our parents, helping our parents find resources for their kids. And so we have some good examples out there. And I want tonight somebody was talking about, you know, the imposter syndrome. The imposter syndrome is real, but it's two-faced. Some of us suffer from the imposter syndrome and I'm better than what I think I am, and we know who those individuals are. And some of us suffer as in I'm not as good as they are or what they want me to be. And so that's a phenomenon that we really need to get a lot of counseling on and a lot of work on to really understand it, to let people know even in your most natural state, you are good enough. And so with that, I would like to close and say thank everybody. Stay prayerful and stay safe and stay healthy. And thank you for joining us on the show tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Nobles. And although I had announced that, Dr. Nobles' comments would be the last, I see that Jesus Muhammad Ali, who had left us, has returned. So I definitely don't want to close the show without giving you the opportunity to make a final but very concise closing comment, because I am actually ready to end the show for tonight. So, Jesus Muhammad Ali, you go right ahead.
Thank you very much. Thank you, sir. You man, my boy. Yes, sir. I'd like to only say our people in this country, we are recognized by virtue of the fact that we represent like $1.4 trillion buying power. See, in a capitalist society, they identify you, you know, and segregate us according to our buying power. So I can't, it's not fair for us to dismiss ourselves. And I would only also go to, you know, the lyrics of our songs. You know, so many of our young people walking around with these earpieces in, they always listen, and the lyrics of our songs, you know, are morally debased in great part. You can't even listen to the lyrics, you know, without being just heartbroken. You know, and I'll go to my book that I wrote, you know, 20 years ago. You know, I passed out more than 2,000 or 3,000 copies of that book walking the streets of Detroit, getting a chance to know people one-on-one. And as it applies to that, the, you know, young people walking through the streets, you know, I have they ask me, how are you doing old school? And I tell them, I say, some of y'all act like y'all not even interested in getting old, you know. So, I mean, that sounds really harsh, but, you know, like in my book, I mentioned how the it's a 50% chance you make, if you're born black in America, it's a 50% chance you won't make your 25th birthday. That's a statistic in this country. And when I took this book to the Emirates, and they were telling me that this book is an indictment against your country, you know, so these are real facts. I mean, even the current president, he came to office, he talked about, first president to mention, systemic racism. This is a real and blunt problem. We have a crisis amongst our young people in this country. And we have to, you know, I know, and I certainly appreciate those who are in academia who are working, you know, I say, hands-on, and you get into the details and the minutiae, and, you know, but I want to say it's Sister Baena, and I certainly appreciate her reference to my grandmother, Sister Clara. But Sister Clara, you know, the University of Islam, that name was given by Master Farad Muhammad. You know, I graduated from the University of Islam. That was a name coined by Master Farad Muhammad, okay? So that's the name which I recognize, and my grandmother, she also recognized. And even if someone wanted to say that they want to put her name on a school, I believe that she herself, she would be an abject objection to that, because she deferred to the one who, Master Farad Muhammad, as being, she referred to him as being her savior. Okay, you know, so I'll just leave that at that, and I want to, you know, say be safe and God bless you all. And with that, I just want to thank you for listening. give excellence to all those who are within the sound of my voice. Thank you very much, really. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jesus Muhammad Lee. With that closing comment, we will end our program for tonight. We want to thank all of those who were in the virtual family room as panelists, as participants in our discussion. And we want to thank all of you who listen via the Internet and encourage you next week that you will come on as active panelists so we can hear what's on your mind. With that said, God bless you. Stay safe and bear in mind that the COVID is still raging. People are still getting very sick, and many are dying as we speak from COVID. So still take all the necessary precautions to protect yourselves and your families. May God bless you to have a great upcoming week, and we hope you'll join us again on next Saturday at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. And with that, we close.